thought, oh my gosh, there's virtually no time, you know, with this president. This is 2 years ago. And now here we are in 2016.
Will President Obama create a marine monument in Alaska? Some hope yes, others no. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, concern over improper dental instrument sterilization at YKHC in Bethel.
We've put additional sign-offs on the sterilization, assigned specific people to sterilization. We're also doing a timeout for sterilization at the actual patient's chair.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
These are the days when a president turns to thoughts of legacy. As the months tick down on this administration, President Obama has created a Marine National Monument off New England and last month vastly expanded one near Hawaii. Alaska interest groups are working to get his attention too. Some want him to take bold action in the 49th state before he leaves office, and others are urging him to resist those calls. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
A TV ad ran in Washington, D.C. this month, flashing footage of oil tankers bathed in the golden light of a Valdez sunset, an offshore drill rig, and Alaska natives on the tundra.
Tell the White House to keep the Arctic in the next offshore leasing program. It's the right thing for Alaska. It's the right thing for our nation.
It's part of a six-figure ad campaign by a coalition that includes the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, unions, and the Independent Petroleum Association of America. They took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post, too. Meanwhile, environmental groups are working just as hard to make sure President Obama knows how much they want the Arctic Ocean tracks removed from the offshore leasing plan due out this fall. That's one way the president might choose to leave his mark on the 49th state. Or he could do something really dramatic, like use his powers under the Antiquities Act to declare a national monument in Alaska or off its shores. Senator Lisa Murkowski dreads a White House announcement like that, which she believes would diminish Alaska's opportunities.
We've seen some indication that he doesn't plan on any ocean protection designation, but until we're on the very last day of the administration, I'm not going to rest and believe that that's the case.
But some Alaskans are hoping Obama will help them preserve their marine environment. Austin Amasek of Nome is trying to marshal federal and local support for an executive order about managing the Bering Strait. Amasek is a marine advocate for Kuwerik, the native nonprofit of the region. He says locals are concerned about increased pollution from ship traffic.
At each point that our tribes have, you know, considered the issue of the Northern Bering Sea and climate change and shipping, we have asked, you know, basically pleaded with the Coast Guard that no discharges occur.
Amasek says they're still working on an executive order they'd like the president to sign, although they started quite a while ago.
At that time, we thought, oh my gosh, there's virtually no time, you know, with this president. This is 2 years ago. And now here we are in 2016, and we think we have, of course, even less time now.
Another person feeling deadline pressure is Pat Pletnikoff, the mayor of St. George, one of the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea. He does not want a presidential order, but he'd like to see the waters around St. George protected. Pletnikoff says St. George is witnessing some upsetting changes, like the loss of vast bird populations.
You know, we see a lot of seals on our rookeries at St. George Island dead, and they're dying because they're probably starving.
Pletnikoff is wary of opposition from the fishing industry, so he wants to nominate St. George for possible designation as a marine sanctuary. That's a public process that can take years. Pletnikoff says it would be more transparent.
We're not looking to close off massive areas of sea to non-fishing. What we want to do is start to understand what it is that the fur seal population and the seabird population require in the way of food in order to thrive.
Though he isn't asking for an executive order, Pletnikoff has taken his case to the White House, to Obama's top Arctic advisor. Pletnikoff knows this is a critical time for marine conservation.
A lot of the folks talk about the fact that perhaps the president would like to leave a legacy, and they've already done that significantly in the Hawaiian area, and that there's might be some need or desire on the part of the president to do the same thing in Alaska, because he's the first sitting president that has visited north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska.
If President Obama is planning to declare any monuments in Alaska or off Arctic shores, he's keeping his cards close to his vest. BLM Director Neil Cornsey recently told Senator Murkowski at a hearing that he does not know of any planned monuments in Alaska. But he added he's not privy to the president's thoughts. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is offering blood tests to patients treated at their dental clinic between September 13th through the 21st after it was learned that some instruments were only partially sterilized. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
13 instruments were incompletely sterilized and possibly used on patients during that 8-day period. During that time, 191 patients received treatment. YKHC is contacting all of them for testing for hepatitis B, C, and HIV. The good news is the tests are free and the risk of infection is low.
The risk is so low that the CDC and state epidemiology did not recommend a need for doing testing. And so really, going through this process for YKHC is to help quell concerns among any patients that might have been treated.
That's YKHC Vice President of Communications Tiffany Zolkuski. John Nick of Bethel is one of the patients the agency contacted to get tested. He had a routine biannual appointment on September 21st, the last day of the suspected time frame.
And 5 days later, I end up getting a call stating that I needed to go to get a blood test, and they wouldn't tell me any reason why I had to.
Nick got his blood drawn Tuesday afternoon, but said he was still having a hard time getting information from YKHC.
And I called them like the second time asking them, and they said, my manager will give you a call back. I still haven't heard a word from them.
Though Nick had not been called back by Wednesday afternoon, that morning, YKHC issued a press release on the issue and posted information on their website. Nick is now seeking legal representation against YKHC through Valcarce Law Office. To arrange a blood test, Bethel-based patients can do a walk-in. Just check in at registration and ask for a test in the lab. Village-based patients will be contacted by healthcare providers who will arrange blood tests for them in the village or in Bethel. Anyone who gets tested will need a follow-up test in January. The first test is to see if the patient already has an infection. The second test is to see if the patient has developed an infection that could be linked to YKHC's instruments. That's because it takes weeks to months before a test can detect the infections in the body. Zolkuski with YKHC says of all the people treated by the clinic, only a few might have been exposed to unsanitary dental tools.
Of the 191 in the population that were treated during that week, only 13 might have been affected. No more than 13, but possibly less.
YKHC isn't able to trace which instruments were used on which patients. YKHC Vice President of Hospital Services Jim Sweeney says the clinic discovered the error on September 21st.
One of the technicians who was preparing to get a patient ready for a dentist noticed that the bag that she had was not sterilized. So she brought that up to her superior's attention, and then we began to do our sort, our inspection of our stock, and then we started looking back on the records to find out why that bag got out there.
Sweeney says the dental clinic has made changes to prevent this from happening again.
We've put additional people, additional sign-offs on the sterilization, assigned specific people to sterilization. We're also doing a timeout for sterilization at the actual patient's chair. So prior to a dentist working on a patient, they're doing a timeout and verifying that the equipment was all sterilized.
YKHC also plans to bring in an outside sterilization expert to review the sterilization processes in the dental clinic and throughout the hospital. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The state has reached a settlement over its problem-plagued Medicaid payment system, agreeing to pay the vendor hired to implement the system $25.9 million it is owed, provided certain terms are met. State Health Department spokeswoman Sarana Shell says the department received thousands of hours of work it won't have to pay for, and says the vendor, Xerox State Healthcare LLC, assigned new management to the project. Xerox is to provide $1.5 million in hardware system upgrades, among other things. The state has spent about $112 million on the system so far. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a long list of sports complaints at the Ketchikan School Board meeting.
We should be negotiating our hardest. Juno Douglas or Sitko or whomever should not be getting off the hook because we didn't do our job.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Salmon Life is an ongoing storytelling project celebrating the unique connections Alaskans have with their salmon. Explore the beautiful stories, meet the people, and help build a statewide community united by salmon love by visiting salmonlife.org. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A victim of shooting last week near Anchorage's Russian Jack Park has died. 40-year-old Paula Zarowski was shot on September 22nd while answering her door on Alora Street. Anchorage police have arrested Tommy Hunter Higgs III, Michael Fitzgerald, and Savon Barry, all 18 years old. They're charged with assault, robbery, and APD says the district attorney will amend their charges to include second-degree murder. This morning, APD issued a warrant for a fourth person involved in the shooting, 19-year-old Alonzo Toffby Stewart. Stewart turned himself into police this afternoon. He was charged with second-degree murder, armed robbery, and misconduct involving a controlled substance. All four are being held at the Anchorage jail. Citing the concerns among his constituents, an Anchorage Assembly member knelt during the Pledge of Allegiance during Tuesday's Assembly meeting. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the gesture comes as political displays around the pledge are increasing, both nationally and closer to home.
Downtown Assembly member Patrick Flynn represents Fairview and Mountain View, two of the most diverse census tracts in the country. As the pledge starts, he keeps his hand over his chest and recites the words, but gets down on one knee.
I've recited the pledge because I respect our country and our community and the men and women who serve it. I also knelt out of respect for those who have expressed concerns that we don't always live up to our ideals, and I'm mindful and respectful of that, particularly since I represent a lot of that population.
Political protests surrounding the pledge have been a contentious topic the last few weeks, both at the national level among professional athletes, as well as several football players from Anchorage's West High, recently taking a knee ahead of a game. Many of those demonstrating say they're drawing attention to unequal treatment across the country to communities of color. The gesture went largely unnoticed during Tuesday night's meeting, with one assembly member saying later on that she thought Flynn simply fell. But towards the close of the evening, Amy Domboski, who represents the conservative Eagle River District, says she was bothered by what happened.
As somebody who looks at the Pledge of Allegiance as something that honors the sacrifices made for men and women who have died defending our country, I find it disrespectful.
But others, including both active duty and retired service members, disagreed with that level of condemnation. A mild counter-protest to the kneel came from Flynn's conservative colleague from South Anchorage, Bill Evans, himself an Army veteran. Evans heard through social media earlier in the day that his colleague was considering making a statement, and he went out of his way during remarks to mention that he'd pinned his jump wings from airborne training to his lapel.
I just thought if, you know, we're going to open it up to, you know, making comments with symbols, I wanted to do the same thing. I think, you know, it's great that, you know, Patrick has the right to express whatever concern he's trying to express, and I just want to make it clear that, you know, other people view it somewhat differently and have, you know, equally valid concern.
Flynn says that for him, it was likely a one-time demonstration. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska has a new target date for opening its cultural immersion park at the old Thane Ore House. Last year, Central Council officials had hoped it would open this summer. Now they're shooting for 2018. KTOO's Lakeed Rashavis reports.
Myrna Gardner is spearheading the Tlingit and Haida Immersion Park project. She says the Central Council wants to put Juneau's native culture at the forefront when cruise passengers visit. Literally, the cruise ships must pass the nearly 3-acre waterfront site before they arrive in port.
Well, when they come to Juneau, you have gift shops and you have art galleries. We want to tie the living culture effect of who we are with it.
Gardner says the park will include classes on totem pole and canoe carving, as well as basic language skills. She says it's important to remember that Southeast Alaska Native cultures are living cultures. There will also be a restaurant, gift shop, and showcases for Alaska Native artists and dance performances.
When you think about places you've gone or traveled, and you read about the history of people, and they talk about them in the past tense, our people have been here 10,000 years. However, today we want you to know that we're still here, and you see it, and you get to talk to people in other communities.
Plans for the park are constantly changing. Over time, Gardner says they plan to line the road up to the property with totem poles from each of the Southeast tribes. Gardner says the park will use the two large buildings on the property for cultural activities.
Our plan is to have a huge Haida-style longhouse cover over it that shows the Haida heritage side. This side, we're going to put a facade of Tlingit longhouses in front of it, so you almost get the image of walking through a village.
Gardner says the estimated $3 million park, plans have expanded since it was pitched as a $1.3 million park last year, will be paid for using a collection of federal grants and Central Council funds. If the buildings need to be rebuilt, Gardner says the park could open in 2018. In Juneau, I'm Lakeed Rashavis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Members of Ketchikan High School's volleyball team came to the Ketchikan School Board last night with a long list of complaints. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Volleyball team captain Kanani Halverson told the board that she felt sexually objectified when a school board member attended a game and polled audience members about how the uniforms fit on the girls.
This poll served to bring unwanted, unnecessary, and inappropriate attention to our athletes' bodies. It should never have been used as a justification to alter our uniforms. My personal take on this is that someone who represents me as a student of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough was found to be the one discriminating, objectifying, and sexualizing me as a young woman and athlete. And personally, as a victim of sexual assault, I refuse to stand for this behavior.
Halverson says she's angry and hurt and wants an apology as well as an independent audit of the district's compliance with Title IX. That's a federal rule that school districts provide equitable opportunities to girls and boys. As a result of that board member's informal poll, Halverson says the school spent $2,000 on new shorts when what the team really needs is new jerseys. But she says nobody asked the team or its coaches. Tylin Ward is one of those coaches. She says there are ongoing issues, but the uniform issue is particularly worrisome because of the attention placed on the team members' bodies rather than their abilities.
That the way our players are being viewed as not athletes, but as girls in booty shorts, if you will, which is not okay.
While not named by the speakers, board member David Timmerman says he was the one who polled people about the uniforms. He says he loves volleyball, and he asked some other female athletes who'd been watching the game why they didn't play that sport. Timmerman says they told him it was because of the uniforms. He says he then polled about 50 people of various ages over the course of a weekend, and everyone told him they were not comfortable with the uniforms.
So me as a parent, also being uncomfortable with some of them, and I'm talking about the very, very short shorts. I want to look down and see everybody as an athlete, and I think everybody in that gym wants to, too. There's people on the national level, there's colleges that are switching to longer uniforms that aren't so revealing. If somebody wants to say that I was objectifying in a sexual manner, that's not it at all. If anything, I'm trying to protect the women, the girls that are out there.
Timmerman did apologize to Halverson and other students who were upset. Another problem noted by speakers was an inadequately supplied medical room for the first couple weeks of volleyball practice. Coach Rebecca Clark says the ice machine wasn't plugged in and there was no tape during a practice when two girls rolled their ankles. Clark also told the board that the activities coordinator apparently dropped the ball on lining up volunteers and referees for a day-long volleyball event, even though a list of names had been provided weeks in advance. Clark says the only certified referee in town was notified 15 minutes before the first game.
Our coordinator did not coordinate it. To me, that's a basic job description. You're a coordinator. It should have been taken care of.
April Edenshaw says the group is concerned about inequity, not just for volleyball, but in how much fundraising is required for various sports.
In some instances, girls are required to fundraise more than boys in activities, even if it is the same activity or sport.
Cheryl Yeisley told the board that because K-High didn't send a representative to a regional sports scheduling meeting, the volleyball team has very few home games and an arduous travel schedule, which will be more expensive than anticipated. That means the team will have to raise even more money than they'd planned for. Hannah Remiski says her granddaughter and other members of the volleyball team will be traveling for games every weekend for 2 months.
The failure to negotiate our games at home is an economic issue for my business, everybody's business, who has to donate to every activity that comes down the pike. It's your issue because you have to pay more to have all these kids travel. We should be negotiating our hardest. Juno Douglas or Sitco or whomever should not be getting off the hook because we didn't do our job.
K-High Principal Bob Marshall told the board that he supports his staff and he hopes that people don't rush to judgment until all the facts are known. He says he will look into the various issues raised by the speakers. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The city of Sitka is struggling to pay off the Blue Lake Dam. The dam is one of the largest in Alaska and was mainly funded through bond proceeds. But a major decline in electric usage by Sitka customers means the city doesn't have enough money to make the bond payment. Faced with this shortfall, the Sitka Assembly debated their options on Tuesday night. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Sitka's electrical usage has plummeted for a number of reasons. The winters have been pretty warm, and a lot of customers are going back to diesel or wood stoves. The result is that the city doesn't have the money it thought it would to pay for the dam. This deficit within the electric fund is $2 to $3 million this year. Now, the assembly could raise rates to pay for it all. An increase by 20 or 22% would do it. But such a prospect did not sit well with them. Many at the table were worried that a rate increase of 20% would drive customers to use even less electricity. Here's City Administrator Mark Gorman.
We're going to stimulate conservation, which pushes us deeper into the hole. It's kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't scenario.
This is the crux of the problem before the Assembly. If they raise rates too little, they risk defaulting on the bond agreement. If they raise rates by too much, usage could nosedive even further. Deputy Mayor Matthew Hunter and Assemblyman Stephen Eisenbeiss were pretty stunned by the magnitude of the problem.
I feel we've jumped off that cliff already.
Say, instead of raising rates, the Assembly were to trim city government, the cut would be about $2 million. That option wasn't palpable for Hunter.
I don't think that's easy to do in a way that doesn't drastically impact our citizens by services or personnel. It's not going to be a fun few years here, guys.
Taking all this in stride, the Assembly did the following. On first reading, they decided to go with a more modest rate increase of 5% for this year. This closes the gap in the electric fund somewhat, but the city is still short $1.3 million. And for that, the Assembly directed city staff to go looking elsewhere for that money before raising rates by 20%.
I'm really not willing to throw a 20% increase on people right now, but without any other money coming in, we have no option.
For their next meeting on October 11th, City Administrator Mark Gorman will talk about other pockets the Assembly can draw from to save the electric fund, like the Southeast Economic Development Fund, the Permanent Fund, or the Bulk Water Fee Fund. None of these are ideal. The whole point of a fund is that it pays for itself. But that's just not the reality when it comes to the electric utility in Sitka. The dam was built. It has to be paid for. The question is, how? Here's City Administrator Mark Gorman.
We're entering kind of an emergency situation, a crisis situation when it comes to managing our electric utility and the affordability of it. So we have to find ways of relieving that pressure on the citizens without compromising our economic integrity.
And it's a crisis the Assembly wants to try to solve in-house before taxing citizens any further. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Lakeed Rashavis in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.